ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Natasha Mitchell here. Hey, if you want to join me at a live event with big thinkers, lots coming up in Brisbane this Friday. A panel on artistic and literary freedom and censorship and sensitivities in this time of fracture. And in August, I'm hosting a whole series of feisty, provocative events at the Byron Writers Festival, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney, and the Great Debate at the Beaker Street Festival in Hobart. To find out more, you can head to the Big Ideas homepage. Just scroll on down and look for Be In Our Audience. Now, on Big Ideas today, look at the label of the last thing you bought. I reckon it's a sure bet it was made by workers in an Asian country, long an apex of human civilization. After colonization and war came poverty. Then globalization and offshoring turned Asia into the engine room of the world economy. But are the very same forces that built that engine now threatening to blow it apart? Supply chains that once connected the world are now being weaponized, and trade is really leverage in geopolitical conflicts. So today, a big picture reckoning with the vast region so crucial to our collective future. Nick Bisley is author of a new book called Asian Crucible, Globalization, Geopolitics and the Contest for the Future. And the Pro Vice-Chancellor Research and Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University joins Dr. Michael Green, who is CEO of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, on Gadigal country.
Might I give you an opportunity to tell us the big arguments in the book? A lot of people write about Asia these days. What was the point you were trying to get across with this book to capture the really contradictory dynamics in the region today? It is the center of global contestation over ideas, technology, nuclear weapons, you name it. And so it's complicated. And there are a lot of different theories about what's happening in this region. And you make a pretty compelling case about what we are seeing. So why don't you tell us that, and then I'll go into some of the specifics.
So the book began life as, I guess, with kind of two big ideas in mind. One was to try to tell the story of Asia as an actually existing place. That's to say, you know, I began my life teaching international relations 25-ish years ago. I was once the young academic. I'm now no longer just an invisible middle-aged white guy at a university. But in those days, in the early 2000s, you didn't really talk about Asia as a place that meant anything other than a kind of shorthand on a map. You talked about Northeast Asia, you might talk about the Asia Pacific in the early 2000s, Southeast Asia or South Asia, but the connections between those different components were pretty thin. Asia didn't really exist in that sense of being an integrated space with a shared sense of economic interdependence or shared sort of security challenges. And what I set out to do in the book is to say, actually, it is an integrated strategic and economic system. It has been brought together by the processes of globalization in particular, and the way in which globalization occurred in a period that I call the era of markets, that runs roughly from the early 1990s until COVID. And in particular, it was integrated by the way in which international production moved away from the kind of Fordist models that had dominated in the post-Second World War period to what economists and others call the kind of value chain model of production, in which firms and countries can specialize in quite small areas of expertise and be able to access opportunities for trade, investment, exports at small scale, and which allow kind of specialization to occur and create the highly complex, highly efficient modes of production that we're familiar with today, and of course, which snarled up so visibly during COVID and which are sporadically snarling up again today. And that process of international value chain production that was really driven by globalization, knitted the different parts of Asia together, and created what I call a China-centered but not Sino-centric system in the region, because ultimately the dominance, size, scale, but also where China was at a particular moment in time. So the PRC in the 1990s and early 2000s is ideally placed because not just of its size, but where its education levels were at, where its population was at in terms of its economic development, the ways in which the Communist Party had established big, sophisticated infrastructure in ports and railroads, which meant that it was able to capitalize on the opportunities that emerged. So the first purpose of the book is to make the case for Asia. And there's a bit of a subtle dig against people who argue for understanding the region as the Indo-Pacific. And we can dig into whether that's a fit. I mean, I had the first version of the book had a much longer, much more kind of not quite ad hominem, but a sort of much more fulsome critique of the idea of the Indo-Pacific, which I parked because, as my publisher pointed out, this is a book about Asia. It's not a book against the Indo-Pacific. But it was, you know, what I'm trying to argue is that we now have the four letters of Asia on a map that is a real meaningful integrated zone. So the point is to make the case not just that Asia's, you know, and in many respects it's a case that we're pretty familiar with, of Asia has grown rapidly and it's become very successful and it's become an important part, if not the most important theater in global politics. But the way in which it came together, the way in which globalization knitted the region together, at the same time reanimated geopolitics. Because one of the striking features of that period of the era of markets, of the sort of, you know, 30-year period from the 90s to the early to 2020, was the almost complete absence of geopolitical competition. It begins to come to the surface in the mid-teens, you know, roughly, you know, let's say 2015-ish through until COVID, you begin to see rising geopolitical competition. Trump administration calls this out very explicitly in its 2017 national security strategy, where it says, you know, the US is turning its back on the global war on terror and focusing on geopolitics, and China is, you know, threat number one. But up until that point, even though geopolitics is sort of re-emerging, at the time, people like me are on the record as saying, yes, we have rising geopolitical tension, yes, there's competition, but globalization, interdependence, shared economic interests are going to keep the worst from happening. That the kind of guardrails, if you like, that are created by shared economic interests mean that the worst excesses are likely to be kept in check. Yes, there's risks. No one's going to say Taiwan, Korean Peninsula or elsewhere is a risk-free zone. But the idea of the US and of Washington and Beijing squaring up against each other in the style of a sort of 1930s proper old school great power military contest seemed fanciful. And it seemed fanciful because of these kind of golden handcuff, golden straitjacket, you know, whatever the metaphor, choose your metaphor. And of course, so the argument I've got is globalization knits the region together. It has a sort of tragic underpinning, tragic second side, which is it animates geopolitics, it animates nationalist ambition. But what is transformative are the years of the pandemic. Now, I'm slightly biased in that I'm based in Melbourne, and of course, the pandemic years, Melbourne was the most locked down city in the world outside the PRC. So there's a little PTSD kind of management in the book in all of that. But seriously, my sense is that what occurs in the COVID years, what I'd argue in the book, is that the COVID years act as this dramatic hinge by undercutting the political foundation or consensus around globalization and the era of markets. It shows us very clearly how vulnerable we are to just-in-time manufacturing interdependence. It surfaces very clearly geopolitics and sort of turbocharges the geopolitical rivalry between the US and China. I think it's important to remember that when we look back on the first Trump administration, it really isn't until 2020 that the hawks are properly unleashed in Washington. There's a trade war, there's lots of tension, but it isn't until Trump basically sees and blames Beijing for undercutting his election prospects in 2020 that the US just says China is now a full-spectrum competitor. So geopolitics is turbocharged by the pandemic years. The pandemic years also undercut the political foundation around globalization, but also it accentuates this sense not just of vulnerability, but the way in which globalization and economic interdependence is becoming a front line of competition. So that, you know, we know in Taiwan, 90% of the world's high-performing chips are made in this island that is claimed by the PRC that has effective independence, that the United States has legislation that says it will defend. The fact that that has occurred is a product of the era of markets, that this tripwire has effectively been set up and is now not just a frontline in strategic competition in the sense of it being a tripwire, it's also something that those chips are something that literally the countries are competing with each other about, because these chips are seen as, rightly, the sort of frontier technologies that will command the heights of the global economy in the future. And so you've got globalization effectively, almost as we're living through it, is being recast. So if you think of, in sort of simple terms, prior to COVID, the balance of the state and market in how the global economy functions was, the balance of power was tipped very heavily in the favor of markets. States saw that the efficiency that you get from letting markets kind of rip was worth, you know, costs. Everyone knew what the costs were around inequality and all these various other things, but the benefits outweighed the risks. And so the state gave markets their head. Where we are now is that balance has shifted. Geopolitics has a much more dominant role to play than it did previously. We are uneasy about the vulnerabilities of globalization. We want to put, and the political sentiment is very clear, we want to put political guardrails around the global economy and how, you know, what gets made where, under what circumstances, for whom and what price. This is not something with which we're now content to let the market have its head. But what we don't know is exactly how it's going to be reconfigured, what that balance is going to look like, because it is being reconstituted what feels like on a daily basis. So the main aim of the book is essentially is to tell that story of Asia as the interplay of globalization and geopolitics in the making of Asia. The COVID years is this hinge point where those two forces are then pushed into a very different trajectory. And then I look out into the future to think about how those two forces interact to create scenarios and to sort of stylize out some scenarios to map out, to try to think through where we may be going, and then make some, hopefully, useful recommendations to avoid the worst outcomes. Kind of, what is it? It's not quite trigger warning because it's not that explicit, but to let you know in advance, it's gloomy. The future is not great. And it's really a question of ensuring we avoid the worst possible outcomes. I think it is very difficult to imagine a world in which the US and China, we go back to a kind of 2004 era of George W. Bush, Hu Jintao style, we can get along, we can do business, neither sees the other as a significant threat. Those days are never coming back. Free trade of the kind we imagined is never coming back. And it's a question of what things look like.
It's always the cheery guys like Nick that tell you the world's going to end. What I found really compelling and what really drove the book nicely was this idea that the current era of disruption and contestation and geopolitical rivalry was actually born in part of regionalization and globalization, which for most, I don't know how many students or professors here are teaching or taking international relations theory, but typically you have sort of two theories competing with each other. One is Thucydides and realism and the world is anarchic, and the other is sort of liberal institutionalism. And so the liberal institutionalists argued the antidote for geopolitical rivalry is globalization and regionalization. And it was particularly strong in scholarship in Australia at the ANU and UCIT in particular, this idea that the regional identity, regional integration, globalization, all these things were basically a path, and the other path was rivalry. And maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but the sad irony is that actually globalization created this deep sense of, it did two things, as you explained. One is it created a stronger sense of region, which in turn created a space for competition, but probably more fundamentally, it created mutual vulnerabilities. And if you look at the growing rivalry between Japan and China, a lot of it was fueled by the hollowing out of Japanese industry, or Korea, or the US, something Australia experienced less. So the interdependence actually became a source of rivalry, which I think is going to really confound and challenge students and faculty to think about how they apply theory to the region, because it sort of is turning, in some ways, liberal institutionalism on its head.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I said this in the book, and that's the future we got was not the one we imagined we were going to get.
Yeah.
Because we thought as globalization expanded, institutions expanded, interdependence grew, and at the time, great power rivalry was gone, it was kind of banished, and really felt like we kind of cracked the code, that we'd found a way in which great powers could get along, mutual economic benefits would underpin all of this. Yes, there was risks that had to be managed, but ultimately, you know, the path ahead looked pretty rosy. And instead, what we got was where we are today, with proper Division I, Grade A, great power rivalry, two major powers, nuclear armed, at the cutting edge of just about every conceivable measure you can think of, and China, you know, moving up a lot of league tables with a bullet, both have irreconcilable visions of the region, irreconcilable visions of the respective roles one another will play in the region, and each have scenarios in which they are prepared to fight kind of very major wars to achieve it. So you've got this, and that's why it's sort of described as a kind of tragedy of economic development, that as Asia is integrated, it has fueled not a cosmopolitan, integrated, liberal utopia, the opposite. We've got a nationalist, a region where nationalism is on the rise. And it's not just a kind of, you know, and I think it's important to remember in Asia, nationalism is a force that has historically been thought of as a positive force. You know, this is something that galvanized anti-imperial sentiment. This was the thing that allowed, you know, the people of Indonesia to think of themselves as inhabiting a shared space, to throw off the Dutch and to fight, you know, major wars and really pay a high price for something that didn't exist. You know, the idea of Indonesia literally did not exist. And yet, so it has this powerful connotation. But what we've got, I think, alive in many corners of the region, not everywhere, is a dangerous nationalism that's grievance-filled, that's backward-looking and victimised. And that is a very febrile combination.
Acclaimed international relations scholar Nick Bisley is author of Asian Crucible, Globalisation, Geopolitics and the Contest for the Future. He's our big thinker today here on Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, coming to you on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen and as podcast. And Dr. Michael Green from the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney is leading this conversation, which I reckon you might have views on. The Radio National text line, get in touch, 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. Or you can email us too. Our show's email is bigideas@abc.net.au. Now, what exactly defines the vast, hugely diverse region we call Asia? That's not straightforward.
I'm going to encourage our mutual friend, Rory Metcalf, at the ANU to listen to this ABC program so you can now trigger him. Why do you not like the Indo-Pacific, which he has championed for 20 years?
The Indo-Pacific makes sense as a way of thinking about military competition at sea, and that's it. I don't think it makes sense to understand the rich cultures, civilizations, and my glib throwaway line is the Indo-Pacific is not, as a nice place, people live in Asia. And the people and the societies and cultures are there. And also from a military point of view, it's historically, Europeans have looked at Asia from a maritime point of view, because that's how we got here. We sailed up, gunboat diplomacy and all that sort of stuff. Whereas the region historically and in the contemporary moment is as much continental. It's the dry land, it's the places where people live, but also the strategic spaces that can be mobilized. And I think to understand our region is you need to understand both the continental and the maritime component, and Asia's four letters. It's efficient.
Ah, there we go. It's good for tweeting. No, I'm fascinated by that because the reality, as you know, is that the definition, the geographic definition of Asia is contested. For 2,000 years, it wasn't contested. It was China and the barbarians. But who is in Asia, who's not in Asia, is a competitive point. And so the Japanese, the Australians, the Indians, the Americans like Indo-Pacific because we like having India in the balance of power because of China. The Chinese don't like it. The Koreans have sort of shifted towards it. So it's not like the European geographical space where there's a Roman and Holy Roman and various sort of imperial periods that stamped it. Asia's contested. And so to me, Indo-Pacific was less about an economic regional interdependence and more about who's in. Mm-hmm. Who do we want in the barroom brawl on our side?
And it had that strategic orientation. And you're absolutely right. I mean, just channel my inner lecturer for a moment. You know, regions are contested. Regions are the products of, they serve a particular purpose and they reflect a particular configurations of interests at a moment in time. And, you know, the Indo-Pacific came out of that period. It has an interesting thing. The Indo-Pacific has a longer history. You talk to Australian historians about the Indo-Pacific and they say that's how we talked about Australia in the 19th century because it was a two-ocean country. Everyone lived on the coast of the Pacific, but everything came from the Indian Ocean because it came from British India. And it went, stopped at Perth, and then it sailed around the coast. So there's these interesting sort of echoes. But one thing that didn't make it into the book was a long discussion of the origins of the term Asia, which my publisher said, this is all very interesting, but this book's supposed to be about the future and you're not a historian. So, but it is, it's a term, and interesting, the term Asia comes from outside of Asia, and as does the Middle East. And these terms have been taken from that kind of European history and owned very much by the inhabitants of the continent. But, you know, where the line is drawn is interesting, and historically it's moved around at various points in time. From a European point of view, the Caucasus sort of settled as this line as to, you know, one side of the Caucasus Mountains is Europe and the other side is Asia. If you've ever been to the Caucasus, they make the Australian Alps look impressive, you know, i.e. they're not very high, they're not an obvious border. This is not the Pyrenees, this is not the European Alps. And actually, if you look into the history, it basically was put there to allow the Russians to feel as if they were part of Europe. And so there's this sort of, you know, there's an arbitrariness to where you draw the line. And where there's arbitrariness, then you have an interplay of state purpose, function, interests, and the like.
One of my useless hobbies is figuring out where different foreign ministries, how they define Asia and who's in and who's out. And in my own experience in the Pentagon or the White House, I worked on East Asia, but in the White House, I was in charge of Asia, but it was the Indo-Pacific. We added India for strategic reasons. It wasn't that there was a discovery about the Silk Road or some historical architectural or cultural connection. It was we needed Indian power in the balance of power. But my favorite is when Beijing announced the Boao Forum for East Asian Economic Cooperation, and they had a big press conference, they had a big map, and they took Australia and New Zealand off.
Fair enough. I was hoping you'd say there was some, you know, obscure State Department official with a love of the Tamerlan Empire and decided to expand.
We could go down this rabbit hole forever, but I will briefly tell you one story, which is in the State Department, Australia and New Zealand get usually tagged, it used to be tagged the Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And for a while, Australia and New Zealand were put under the guy in charge of North Korea, so he could at least get some, you know, respite from dealing with the North Koreans. All right, the periodization, as historians call it, is also very interesting. You start with an anecdote about the 2010 Senkaku crisis, when a Chinese fishing militia, quasi-military fishing boat, collided with a Japanese Coast Guard vessel. They arrested the captain. Massive embargo against Japan in 2010. You focused, though, mainly on COVID. But you could start in 1995, 96 with the Taiwan Strait crisis, which for Washington and Tokyo and Taipei was the first big warning that we have a problem, that economic interdependence does not guarantee a cooperative future, or the 2008-2009 financial crisis, which some people point to as sort of a major revelation for Beijing that the West is in decline. But you focused on COVID, and I was not expecting to be convinced, because that's not what you would hear in Tokyo or Washington, but I'm kind of convinced. So say a bit more about why COVID, because of your main argument, because COVID revealed the vulnerabilities that came from the economic interdependence of supply chains and so forth. But it obviously did for Australia, because China embargoed Australia over the Morrison government's efforts to investigate the causes of COVID-19. So for Australia, it's specifically so. But you make the case about the overall tapestry of economic interdependence and how it really made people feel not safe. But say a bit more about that, because that's going to be the part when people review this book outside of Australia that they're going to scratch their heads and sort of debate and think about it. And I'm mostly convinced, actually.
Oh, good. I'm pleased. I've got you and my father. So, and you know, as you all know, without getting too kind of Freudian, my father's my most skeptical reader. So, yeah. So just a couple of things about those other dates. I think you're right that there's, when you're looking at this period, where you put the lines and go the dynamic shift, there are these various, you know, candidates, I guess, for where to bookend the period. And I started with the story in 2010 is essentially an anecdote that the forces that I'm exploring in the book have been visible on the surface for a little while. You know, so it's 2010. The book's focused on the dynamics leading into and out of the pandemic. And that means they're at least a decade old, if not older. The, you know, doubts about, questions about, concerns about globalization have been around since globalization's been around. It's slightly disconcerting that Pauline Hanson is still here, but she was elected in 1997 on the back of the kind of first wave of anti-globalization sentiment that was both cultural and economic. And you had Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, you had Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan in the 90s. So there's these various elements. But the reason I've focused in particular on the period of 91 to 2020 was because in my analysis, that's when you have these big forces of globalization and geopolitics working almost, you know, this sort of globalization is the dominant force, and it creates this high level of prosperity in the region, and even pulls South Asia into its orbit. you know, because at the start, and just as a little kind of factoid, it's a fact. In 1991, so the start of this period, the PRC is 1/10 of the American GDP. It's 1/10. Now, depending on, by the start of COVID, depending on how you slice it, it's either the same size or not far off the same size. So this is a stunning transformation. Same thing is happening in South Asia's on a similar trajectory, or India in particular, but coming from a much lower base. And it gets pulled into this story of economic prosperity. To me, the bookend is not 2008-09, the global financial crisis, primarily because in Asia, it wasn't that big a deal. So primarily in Asia, the American side of it was a big deal, but the Western Pacific coastal states, even in South Asia, they experienced it as a secondhand crisis. That's to say, basically as a follow-on from the sovereign debt crisis in Europe and the banking crisis in the United States, in terms of how their economies were functioning and how they worked. And in fact, there's the great image in the Khan summit of 2009, where the Europeans came with their begging bowl to the Chinese to bail them out, and the Chinese basically said no. And there's this, you know, the origins, yeah, the home of global capitalism, Europe begging to the People's Republic of China for a capital inflow, and the Chinese say no. But to me, the COVID years are critical for understanding these twin forces, because the underlying conditions of globalization, that is the political forces that allowed it to occur, which is for states to get out of the way and to give markets their space, fundamentally changed because of what happens during COVID. And it's not just the disease. And there's a few things around it. One is that sense of vulnerability I talked about earlier. But there's also a sense that the state could do something. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, scholars at this university famously wrote about how the state was being disempowered by market forces, that the state was in retreat, that the state was sort of powerless. You know, the American political strategist, just gone blank, invented the "It's the Economy, Stupid." I was about to say Billy Bob Thornton, but you know,
he played him in the movie.
James Carville, you know, famously said if he could be reincarnated as anything, what would you like to be reincarnated? He said, as the bond market, because it's the only thing that can tame the government. So this is, you know, this sense of the power of the bond market can keep the state in check. You live through the COVID years and you tell me about markets keeping the state in check. And what both the GFC, global financial crisis, and COVID showed is when things go wrong, when things go catastrophically wrong, there's one place you go to get help, and that's the state. Not international institutions, not clubs of like-minded, it's your state, and a nationalist statist conception. And that fact of wanting to see off vulnerability, but also kind of reanimating a sense of confidence that states could be in charge of their destinies, I think has really reconfigured how the global economy is going to function. So that's why I sort of take it up to 2020. So, and you ultimately, these things can end up being a little arbitrary in the sense that, you know, it's not like you wake up on the 15th of March 2020 and go, aha, the era of markets is over and we're now in a new era. These things only become clear, I think, with a degree of hindsight. But it's that 91, end of the Cold War, defeat of communism, the dominance of liberal capitalism runs this era of markets, runs until COVID. It gets scrambled, and we are now in a period of what I describe as scrambleization. It's an ugly word, deliberately chosen to be ugly to reflect the ugliness of the way in which the global economy is working. So it's a sort of scrambled reconfiguration of state and market principles. But also geopolitics. So that's the second sort of pillar, if you like, of the argument, or the second main force. It is also transformed during this period. So it's beginning to appear and it's resurfacing in Asia. You know, we used to have this sort of sense that Asia, as I said before, had kind of cracked the code and had pushed great power competition away, only to see it reemerge with real vengeance. You know, it popped up in various crises, but we managed to sort of see it off. But through the COVID years, and it's a combination of mistrust about China, and I think it's important to remember that as we're going into COVID, so sentiment about the PRC is shifting slowly, and certainly in Australia, it's driven by concerns about rising authoritarianism, whether that's Xinjiang, whether that's in Hong Kong. And then COVID comes along, and the PRC is absolutely culpable in the expansion of COVID. COVID could have been kept in check. COVID could have been like SARS. And I think had COVID been like SARS, so this is the similar coronavirus-style disease in 2002, which similarly, zoonotic disease coming from the south of China spread to a number of Southeast Asian countries, but it was a six-week crisis where a few thousand people died. So if it had been like that, I think we'd be in a quite a different world now. I don't think that things would look like they do. I think the trajectory is clear, but I think globalization would still be in, it would be in a more dominant position and geopolitics would be in a less significant position. It's hard to replay this because if you don't have COVID, does Putin invade Ukraine? Very hard to know that. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that is the case, everything from the sort of paranoid dictator locked away in his castle in the Kremlin feeling that this was his moment in the sun. But I think that if you do the thought experiment of the, not having the COVID years, I think you have a very different dynamic. You still have competition, but it's operating at a different timeline.
You are joining Nick Bisley, Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University, and Michael Green, who is CEO of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Yes, very big, with me, Natasha Mitchell. And we're considering Asia's extraordinary economic rise, understanding its history, the current threats, and potential future, which has never been more important for our economic interdependence.
So when you're trying to understand a transformation in the international system or in the regional dynamics, you isolate structure, which you've done, and you've explained that a large part of the disorder that's emerged is precisely because of globalization, regionalization. That's a structural thing. And then contingency and COVID, the global financial crisis, COVID in particular, contingency that did what you just said. But in analysis, then you also have to look at agency. And a large part of what's happening, if you're in US or Japan, would be Xi Jinping's strategy. So yes, you had COVID. Yes, you had these challenges to globalization. Yes, it made it harder to make the case for independence and so on and so forth. But in 2014-15, you know, China built up the South China Sea military zone with the artificial islands and massive airfields. In Shanghai in April 2014 announced that Asian security should now be handled by Asians without outside blocs, meaning the U.S. Made in China 2025 in 2015, where China under Xi declared that it would dominate all the emerging technologies, not be competitive, but dominate them. And so you have this series of things that are somewhat, I think, disconnected from the contingencies that you described. So how do you account for intent? Because when this debate happens in the U.S., one of the big questions is, had there been no Xi Jinping, would these other factors not have been so grave? So it's not so much in the book, but let me ask you, how do you account for Xi and agency and intent?
I had to write one book, not two.
I'm giving you ideas for the next book.
It was something that I was back and forth on, and it is a book that operates at a bit more of a macro level than some people would like. I mean, a couple of things just as context. Xi Jinping's rise in many respects was completely unexpected, in the sense that I think China watchers and plenty of people in the party itself figured that there was a model, this technocratic model, collective leadership, 2 5-year terms, post-Mao consensus was there. It had done an enormous amount of good to the country. And I think we all sat there and thought, we're going to get more of the same. And in many respects, Xi Jinping at first glance sort of looked like that. And the kind of ripples on the surface as the South China Sea, and it's important to remember the South China Sea dredging began before his accession to power. And I remember at the time in sort of 2011, 2010, there's sort of discussion about this, what's going on. And a lot of the thinking was this was arm wrestling in the PLA prior to the transition. Right. That this was not in fact, but it was in fact, as we now know, it's about Xi Jinping, and he has proven, as many people in the room will know, he's proven to have been a surprise to many, including all of the people he's locked up, including some of his closest friends in recent times. But I think when he came to power, his perception of the PRC and where it was, and in particular of the fragility of the political and economic system that he had inherited, if that's the right term, was very real. I think he looked at particularly corruption within the party and saw this as an existential challenge, not just to party rule, but to the state, to the functioning of the PRC, and used that as not only as a mechanism to reinforce his power, but to sort of take China on quite a different position.
I think the sense of international ambition was transformed by the global financial crisis. So the PRC elites in 2008, 2009, or coming out of the crisis, so 2009, 2010, are faced in a world in which they find themselves presented with an international environment in which they're now that unambiguously the number two economy, and external players, not just the Europeans coming with their begging bowls, are saying, you're a great power, you have responsibilities, and you need to do things. You need to lead, you need to pay for public goods. And the PRC is internally going, this wasn't in the playbook. This was supposed to happen in 30 years. This was supposed to happen a generation from now. They're expecting it, roughly speaking, planning for it, but not at that point in time. And I think the sense that of opportunity emerged slowly through the leadership, but unmistakably the Xi Jinping and the leadership looked out at a world and saw a world in which, A, they had, you know, the balance of forces had shifted in their favour, as they sort of like to think of it, and as they began to explore a more assertive and a more adventurous approach to the region, they didn't get much pushback. You know, you've got a combination. Why does Xi Jinping's foreign policy look the way it does? I think it's partly opportunistic. I don't think it's sort of great grand plan that he's had in his back drawer since he was 10. And it's partly opportunistic because of, you know, these spasms in the global economy caused by, you know, banking crisis in the US. So, but I think you put your finger on exactly the right point, which is the reanimation of geopolitical competition is, you know, if you had to point to a single cause, it's the transformation of the PRC, its shifting attitude to its place in the world, its rising ambition that sits on the back of justifiable sense of confidence in the transformation that the party state's achieved. You know, that to go from where it was in 1978 to where it is at the turn of the start of the COVID pandemic is staggering. And I'm of a certain age that I went to the People's Republic of China in 1982. Across the border from Hong Kong, to go from Hong Kong to Shenzhen, which if you do now, it's very hard to tell the difference. But if you did it then, it was going back 100 years. You'd take a train ride for 30 minutes and you went from the 1982, 1983 to 1882. You know, there was barely electricity. This was, the difference is just staggering. So the PRC's transformation is the big driver of a much more contested and competitive region, and then, you know, the Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, everyone then has to reconfigure, and we've got this combustion.
We all kind of know that, and what your book does is explain the operating software
exactly.
That could not handle it, precisely, ironically, in some ways, because of globalization and regionalization. Yep. You have three scenarios. One is a kind of concert of Europe, and you say, not going to happen, I agree, because we can, you know, not... Yeah. Anytime soon, anyway. Second is the most
dangerous. No grand bargain here. No G2.
There's no G2. It's not going to happen. The second is a fractured Asia, which is obviously the most dangerous and sort of is like today, but even more contested, more danger, more threat of conflict. And then you say the third scenario, which can be achieved, is a rebalanced Asia, which is probably, if you are going to get some day off in the future to a concert of Asia, the only way you get there. And I think, by the way, that is a common assumption for the governments, at least, of all of Australia's major partners, Japan, the US, Korea, India, is that we have to have a balance of power to get through this period. So say a little bit about how we do that. Mm. And Japan, because you don't say a lot about Japan, which is my sort of original area of scholarship. So how do you get a balance of power in a multipolar Asia if you're Australia that sets you up to maybe someday get back to the path towards more of a concert?
Yeah, and I think you can see the bones of it now. Mm-hmm. So this is if you assume that the PRC remains as it is, and I think that's, you know, I think one of the great mistakes of Asia's international relations is to look at the China you have at any given moment and assume it's the China you'll have forever. And we've had four different Chinese political systems in essence since 1949, and they've all been very, very different, both in their internal and external manifestations. But let's assume we continue to have Xi Jinping or something like it for a generation. I think, you know, there's kind of three big things that need to happen. One is the US needs to remain engaged and needs to empower and support its allies. Second, its allies need to develop military capabilities that are both individually stronger than they currently are and capable of working in unison, as properly joined up and, you know, probably shouldn't say this on radio, but you know, NATO in Asia type of structure. Without that, I think
the PRC's modus operandi of managing crises bilaterally to use the asymmetries that it has at its advantage will allow it to pick things off. If you're trying to get a genuine balance of power, the only way to manage that is through that multilateral structure. And to go back to the Indo-Pacific point, India needs to be part of that configuration. So I think you can see the bones of it beginning to come together. The problem, I think, that we're seeing already is managing the convergence of interests that's required to do that is very difficult. In all of the state capitals across the region, you see shifting political interests domestically, challenges in domestic political systems, whether that's, you know, we know that the Trump administration has a, frankly, pretty puzzling attitude to the region. I'm still not quite, you know, one of the assumptions I had in the book was, you know, the one thing, there's this huge partisan division in the United States, a lot of, you know, disagreement on just about every conceivable thing. But the one thing we seem to have a consensus on was an attitude towards China, which doesn't seem to be there at the moment.
It's there. It's there. It's all the way right up to Donald Trump's head.
Yeah, yeah. So that's...
and he's not in the consensus.
Yeah. Yeah. So it reminds us, though, that this is not just a chessboard where you've got to align the military forces and make sure you're spending the right amount of money. There is an importance in ensuring that the domestic foundations of that international policy are solid. And that's something where, you know, Japan now under Takaichi's got a very clear vision, and I think it's probably, you know, it's understandable, and I think it's probably the right one for getting the region into a better military balance. How long is the political foundation of her position going to last? In Australia, we have a government that's got a large majority but rests on a very, very thin primary vote that could move. I think it's a lot more volatile than people may recognise. I was listening to a podcast that described, you know, the Australian Labor Party has cracked the puzzle of, you know, and the great statesman of Anthony Albanese knows how to have, you know, he's going to be in power for a generation. It's like, you clearly aren't here if that's your outlook. I think Wayne Swan did that review of the election and says this is a wide majority on a very, very thin foundation. And that's true in many corners of the region. Mm-hmm. So I think the military component in some respects is the easiest one, even though it's not easy at all. And that's before you even begin to look at India. And just to add an Asia component, I think one, the PRC is acutely aware that its most vulnerable component is its sea lanes and its approaches. And that's part of the reason it is spending a lot of time and energy focusing on the hinterlands and focusing on Central Asia, because it gives it, you know, diversity. And if there's one thing we've learned, I hope, over the past 5 or 6 years, is happiness is, my PhD supervisor once had a sticker on his wall that had happiness is multiple pipelines. I remember saying, please explain, I don't understand. He said, you know, multiple pipelines. You want to be able to import oil from lots of different places. I was like, yeah, of course. That economic resilience coming from diversity and diversification, the PRC has lots of options that they'll take a generation to build, but they've got options. So it's going to be a tricky, multi-layered, multi-generational game.
You end up where I think in the right place on, which is we're not going to have an EU in Asia. People thought that 15, 20 years ago. It's not going to happen. And we don't want a further breakdown of order and risk of war. And so working on balance of power is the right way to go. Some scholars would say, well, you do balance of power, you get a security dilemma. You know, if this side tries to balance the other side, it's going to try to balance, and you just keep going and going and you have an arms race. That's the classical rebuttal. But I think in a way that would almost be reassuring for Beijing, almost, because the U.S. depends more than it ever has on allies to be strategically effective in this region, on Australia, especially now, Japan, and so forth, the Philippines, unilateralism is not really an option. And since it isn't, if you have more allies at the table, that actually moderates the U.S. approach in a way you wouldn't get if the U.S. truly could be unilateral in its approach with China. So there is a certain stability to this sort of multipolar, multilateral cooperation. Probably won't become a NATO. If it becomes a NATO, then that's a signature failure of Chinese foreign policy strategy, and I don't think it will happen. But in that sort of middle ground, I think it actually is about the most stable scenario that you can achieve, and you lead the reader to that conclusion, not in a forceful way, just by demonstrating the dynamics.
And if I could add one thing that also has to be part of that is the sort of management of deterrence and reassurance. That's to say, crisis management process is good communication, good understanding between the sides. I think the Cold War is looked back on almost fondly, I think, by some people with this, you know, it was stable and they managed it and this sort of thing. And you must remember how much effort was put into communication, crisis management, all of the things to ensure that, you know, the worst outcomes are avoided. And I think there's some lessons around that that we really need to put in place. And it'll be harder because you've got multiple players with different interests. So managing that is complex.
We don't have time to go into all your recommendations, but that's a key one, is that communication, strategic communication. Why don't we open it up for some questions for Professor Beasley and put your hand up and, yeah, right up in the front here.
Thank you. I had a question about security hybridization. So when Pacific states are keeping two sets of books where they're with China on the economics, but with the United States on security. If that deepens, is there a potential for there to be an equilibrium, or will some contingency force states to choose? Thank you.
I think so far the experience is, you know, China has weaponized some things, but it's, you know, in some areas it's got an ability to force states to do things. In other areas it's shown it's got limits. And, you know, economic statecraft is like any kind of statecraft. Once you show your hand, states go, okay, I'm vulnerable to this. I'll begin to diversify. I think probably the more likely risk is less a kind of China using its economic power to coerce, because it's shown largely that hasn't worked when it's tried to do it in a range of different places, but is states who have historically relied on the United States as a you know, stable, predictable force for, you know, military security, lose confidence in that and feel either that they need to, what do we call it? Look after yourself. There's the internal balancing. You know, you basically look after yourself and build up your military because I'm no longer confident the Americans will be there for me. I think that's probably a more likely scenario that states look at the Trump period and feel that, you know, all alliances, you know, if you enter into an alliance with a senior partner, you always know you're vulnerable to whether your big friend will come to your rescue. You know, there's the risk of abandonment. It's always there. And I think under the Trump administration, that risk has really accentuated for some. And so they may choose to be less dependent on that and cuddle up to China in one form or other. On balance, I think that's unlikely. You know, we're a year and a half into the second Trump administration, although it feels like 10 years. Time does strange things to you. And that was part of actually writing the book over the past 2 years or so. Was a very trying period because of just things moving so quickly and trying to feel like you're shaping an argument. So I hope that answers the question. My sense, I think, is that the risk of the erratic approach of the administration is probably more likely than China exercising leverage.
And to abuse the prerogative of the moderator, the security hybridization argument focuses on trade. Trade is like dating. Foreign direct investment is like marriage. Foreign direct investment for Japan, Australia, Korea, Philippines is overwhelmingly trans-Pacific with the U.S. Half of Australia's technology trade is with the U.S. The super funds, where they invest in the U.S., Japanese, Korean foreign direct investment in the U.S. is rapidly rising. So sometimes that debate just looks at the flow of goods and services, but ignores foreign direct investment, which is, you know, is longer lasting, enduring, and it's a bit of a context that's lost.
And to go back to the Japan question, Japan is, after the US, the second biggest source of foreign direct investment in most of East Asia. When you look at investment, it's a much more complex period, package rather, than if you look at just trade.
Other questions? Yes.
So at the start, you kind of spoke about the Asia growth story, especially from 91 to 2020. So how much of that was due to circumstances and how much due to the kind of existing institutions, whether like political institutions or societal or other institutions? And how will, like, you know, these new geopolitical trends like affect, you know, Asia story?
So in the book, I focus, partly because of space constraints, mostly on the transformation of international production and the way in which it opened up opportunities, so that from my assessment, the big engine for economic growth as an integrative force, so it's not just, so I didn't, partly didn't have space and not really the expertise to really get under the hood of how does economic growth happen in emerging Asia. There's a lot of analysis on it. There's no clear consensus actually about the mix of, you know, institutions, savings rates, culture, work ethic, education levels. There's a lot of variables at play.
Suffice to say, though, that the PRC explicitly sort of modelled itself on the Japanese model. They brought experts in. It was very clear, you know, you've got a playbook, the export-focused industrialization. But to get to the specific question that I focused on is, you know, firms move from being interested in making things to being interested in developing ideas and working out how to put the ideas together at the lowest cost in the most efficient manner. And the classic story of this, as you're probably familiar, is the Apple iPhone. Famously on the back, it says, designed in California, manufactured in China. If you're in the US, increasingly manufactured in India, which I still find, still surprised by that. Apple makes precisely nothing. It manages an immensely complex supply chain. If you're interested in it, read a book called Apple in China by FT journalists. It came out last year. It's excellent in a whole range of ways of getting under how all of this occurs. Multinationals and production moves from being a business about literally making things to being about designs, ideas, and the productive process. And what that does is opens up the ways in which states and firms can enter into that long set of value chains. And that enables a level of efficiency, and that creates a level of intra-Asian trade that we'd never seen before. Asian states go from being countries that competing with each other for inbound investment from the US and Western Europe and competing with each other for exports to being increasingly trading with each other. So by the COVID years, intra-Asian trade is roughly at the level of intra-EU trade. It's not quite, but it's pretty close. And the EU is always considered the gold standard in economic interdependence and trade. And it's those efficiencies that produce the opportunities for growth, but these complex supply chains produce these enormous vulnerabilities. And as we saw during COVID, supply chains can trip up. You know, there's that, if you're talking about supply chains, you know you're in trouble, you know, you know you're in a bad spot. Bit like when we're talking about systems of international order, when you're talking about them, you're in trouble. That's the element that I focus on. And it's that allowing those markets to work in that particular way that created these opportunities for Asia. But where we are now is those are being unpicked. And because they're so complex, you know, if you're a country like Australia or the US that says, we don't want to be vulnerable to supply chain and production from countries that we think are ne'er-do-wells, that are enemies, sometimes we even use that language. If a production process involves, you know, 3,000 steps moving between 15 countries over a six-week period, and you don't even know what's in some of these things or where they're from, how on earth do you secure that? And that's why we're in this sort of scrambled position. And the politicization of this is going to have a clear effect. It is going to slow economic growth. There is no question of that. What we don't know is how much it will slow it. And one of the biggest risks that I sort of point at in the book is the growing sense of the need for the state to intervene, Future Made in Australia as just an example, CHIPS Act in the United States and others. The more barriers to international trade investment that are created, the fewer opportunities for developing Asia. And remember, Asia's a place where still probably not quite half, but nearly half the population lives below the poverty line. So there is a big development story that has to happen. And the more nationalist we get, the less integrated we get, the harder that ladder is to climb.
We should have scheduled 3 hours, but we'll conclude for now and join me in thanking and congratulating Professor Beasley on a terrific piece of work.
So, is the crucible about to crack, or is this just what Asia, what its many nations have always done, adapting, remaking themselves under pressure? I'll let you sit with that one. You heard today from Nick Bisley, Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University, where he is Pro Vice Chancellor Research and author of Asian Crucible, Globalisation, Geopolitics and the Contest for the Future. And he joined host Dr. Michael Green, who is the CEO of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, where this conversation took place. My name is Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.